You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, but who's going to bathe the baby, walk the dog, or take out the garbage? And in an era when both members of a couple earn money, how do you handle their finances? On this Valentine's Day, we are taking a look at what happens during those happily ever after years. Paula Schumann of the Wall Street Journal and Jenny Anderson of the New York Times have co-authored Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes, just out from Random House. And they join me now, along with Jessica Gross, the managing editor of XX and an associate editor at Slate, where she recently wrote a series of articles on marital finances. And I'm very delighted to have all three of them on our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Jessica, you classified married and cohabiting couples into three groups: common potters, the ones who pool their finances. Maybe you should be giving them rather than me tell the whole story.
That's right. There's common potters who pool everything, sometimes sharers who have a combination of joint and separate accounts, and independent operators who are the folks who keep everything separate. And what I found was—
You did a survey of Slate readers?
Yes, survey of Slate readers, almost 6,000 responses, which was tremendously gratifying and surprising. And what I found was basically as couples go along, the longer they're together, the more likely they are to pool some money, which is fairly logical if you think about it. You know, as you go along, you have kids, you buy a house, it becomes more and more difficult to keep everything separate, even if you like having that bit of independence.
And it becomes more difficult to separate, too.
It sure does.
Did one method appear to be more preferable for avoiding conflict?
No. What I found was there wasn't one method that really prevented fighting, although the people who are sometimes sharers, who that's the joint and separate accounts, seem to fight slightly more than everybody else. And I figured that was because you just need to talk about it more often if you are having this sort of conversation all the time. It's like, you know, this expense, a haircut maybe, is that a joint expense or is that a personal expense? So you have to keep recategorizing expenses as they come along.
Paula and Jenny, you based your book on what you call your exhaustive, groundbreaking, and very expensive marriage survey. Whom did you survey and what did you ask them?
We asked them everything. We asked them about their sex lives. We asked them about money. We asked them about what they fight about, how they fight, how long they fight, what they think about when they fight. It was a randomized, professionalized survey done by a professional survey company.
And who paid for it?
We did.
We did.
Oh, out-of-pocket expenses could be rather high for some books.
Well, all in the name of, you know, responsible research.
And you also talk about your listening tour. What was that?
Well, that's where we inserted ourselves into the living rooms of hundreds of people around the country and asked them probing questions about the intimate details of their marriages. So we would sit in a room with maybe 10 women and some wine and some food and share stories and then send them off and bring their husbands in.
Now, I want to go back to you, Jessica, for a moment. Have things been changing? Traditionally, spouses pool their finances when they got married. Has there been a trend away from that?
Absolutely. I mean, there hasn't been as big a trend as I assumed when I first started this series. You know, just talking to my peers, most of the women that were my age, and I'm in my late 20s, wanted to keep some money separate for themselves. And the default before, you know, at least up to 30 years ago, was you combine everything. When you get married, that's just what you do. And I found now the majority of married couples still do combine everything, which was sort of surprising. But there is a large minority who either have this combination of joint and separate and like to have a little individual spending money. And there are even longtime married couples with kids who keep absolutely everything separate, although they are a much smaller percentage.
Well, what about those independent operators? What advantages did they see in keeping their money separate?
It was all about having the sense of independence and not having anyone sort of tell you what to do about your money or having to check with the other person every time you make a decision. However, there was sort of a division in the independent operators. There were the people who really were obsessed with privacy and they didn't even let their spouse or their longtime partner see what was in their bank account. And then there was this full transparency independent operators. And these were people who, even though they didn't share any accounts, their spouses knew exactly what was going on and sort of the basic gist of their finances. And I feel like the latter is sort of preferable.
Well, in most couples, one person earns more than the other, which can lead to the problems. If we're putting it all into one big pot, Well, I'm the one who's putting most of the money in, aren't I?
Well, see, I sort of found that for people who have income disparities, the common pot's a better thing to do, because then you're not having this constant struggle over whose dollar is what. All the dollars are mushed up together in that lovely common pot. So it sort of can gloss over those fights over who's spending what a little bit.
Did things change after they have children?
Yes, definitely. And the group that was most likely to pull everything were people with children, because, of course, children really should be considered a shared expense.
And children are expensive.
And they are expensive.
So let me have my own little poll here.
Sure.
What systems do each of you follow in your marriages?
We are newly sometimes sharers. We, you know, my husband and I lived together for 4 years before we got married, and I still think it's prudent for people who aren't married to keep most everything separate. And now we've been married 8 months as of Friday, I believe, and we are going on the starting to merge more and more. We just went to the bank on Friday.
Jenny?
We are sometimes sharers, but we just had our second child, and I have to say more of our money is just disappearing, so I don't know that there's as much to share. And I do notice the trend toward merging more of the money, if for no other reason, just to write the collective check for some expense.
And Paula?
We are common potters. We moved in together before we got married, and we opened up a joint checking account, and it's so far, fingers crossed, been going pretty well.
So we have the full range here.
Yeah.
What do couples most commonly fight about? Is it money?
Money, kids, fairness. Surprising number of couples still argue about housework. The sense of, you know, it should be, you know, especially, you know, sort of the idea of the modern egalitarian marriage, it should be 50-50.
So this is – here we get into economics, because it's about division of labor.
I can't help it. Yeah. yeah, division of labor. Who's doing more? And like you said, in some couples, one person might be making more money. So there's this sense, well, so is the person who's making less money, who's maybe staying home more, should they be doing more of the housework? And it becomes kind of complicated after a while.
Is it possible to actually divide 50-50?
We would say it's not very practical. 50-50, to Jessica's point of when you're a sometimes sharer, there's a lot to discuss and a lot to negotiate over and hence a lot to argue about. When you're trying to do everything 50-50, that just means you have to keep score. I mean, you have to keep track of what the other person is doing. We met couples who had lists, checklists, they had whiteboards, they had all this stuff to – and it's exhausting, right? I mean, the system we say makes a little bit more sense is comparative advantage, right? Just try to figure out what each of you is relatively better at vis-a-vis other chores. And that takes into account what you care more about. There's a lot of work in a household divided up that way.
Well, you wrote a piece in the New York Times yesterday in which you talked about the whole problem of people not necessarily doing the chores they're expected to do. And it got us into another area, which is nagging. I don't know if that is something
that I'm completely unfamiliar with that
economists
concept.
Write about.
What?
But
the theory of nagging, you've never heard of that? Adam Smith?
enlighten me, forgive the pun. of course.
No, we use it in the context of we talk about incentives, and some people seem to – I mean, incentives are what motivate people to act, and it turns out nagging is not a very effective incentive to get your spouse to do something. You know, people don't sit there and think, well – I better take out the trash or I won't be nagged. It's kind of like, I don't want to live in that kind of world. So it turns out to not be a very effective incentive, which Jenny talked about learning the hard way.
My guests are Paula Schumann, Jenny Anderson, co-authors of Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes from Random House, and Jessica Gross, associate editor at Slate, managing editor of XXX, co-author of Love, Mom, Poignant, Goofy, Brilliant Messages from Home. There's a thing called perverse incentive. What's that?
A perverse incentive is when you hope to do one thing and you do something completely that you hope isn't the outcome. So, for example, in a marriage sense, a perverse incentive might be you think nagging is going to get your husband to do something, and in fact, it gets him to really not want to do it, and maybe he'll try to find ways to avoid doing it.
Avoid being around you.
Yeah, avoid being in the house.
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that there can be perverse incentives in the obviously there are a lot of perverse incentives in the economy as well. Look at the entire housing crisis. I mean, that was one giant perverse incentive. The government tried to give us a bunch of incentives to buy houses, and it created a massive bubble that burst and left a lot of pain for the rest of us.
Well, to avoid the trap, insurers use co-payments and deductibles, don't they, to make a share in the cost of our health care so that we don't abuse it. How can you institute something like that in a marriage?
Well, we have some couples in the book that we talked to, one couple in particular, where she felt they had moved to the rural South and she had moved from the big city, and it felt like she was taking on more of the emotional and physical burden of having switched towns and switched lives and given up her career. And he sort of just assumed, well, they're married. Everything's going to be fine now. You know, just go with the flow. I mean, he's a good guy, but he was a little bit misinformed. So the notion of co-payments and deductibles came in there, where he helped to sort of share the load by making some compromises, being home one day a week instead of working 7 days a week. You know, the idea of co-payments is that you're invested, as you know, insurance companies use it to make sure that people who have insurance don't just take advantage of their insurance all the time. And there's certainly this notion of marriage of not being taken for granted.
Or advantage of. Well, if nagging doesn't work, does praise work? How long will praise work before the other person starts saying, oh, I'm being manipulated here?
I see right through this. I don't know. Have you ever been too complimented in your life? I certainly haven't. Yeah, there is a lot.
Some people are made uncomfortable by being told they're wonderful all the time.
I'm unfamiliar. I'm unfamiliar with that.
No, but I know what you
and,
mean.
And then there's always, you know, like the way we talk to kids, or Will Shortz speaks to participants. Good job. Good job can feel a little patronizing.
Sure. There is a lot of diminishing returns. I mean, there is the possibility that you can do any of these things too much, but certainly probably praise and acknowledgement and trust are more effective incentives than nagging.
I also liked you. We had the three of us did an event at the 92nd Street Y Tribeca, and one of you mentioned linking up an incentive with a small task like taking out the garbage. You talked about a couple who the reward was going to the gym. So whichever spouse did the chore, let's say it was taking out the trash, then that was the person who also got to go to the gym. And I thought, at least in my marriage, I thought that was really applicable in doing, you know, well, things that nobody wants to do, linking it up with a reward.
See, for me, that would mean I would never want to take the garbage out.
Well, your incentives have to be aligned.
Incentive compatibility.
Right,
exactly. You need to want to do the thing at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
But, Jenny, as I mentioned earlier, you had a piece in Yesterday's Times in which you talked about nagging, despite the fact that you had worked on this book and your husband asked you if you'd read chapter 4 or whatever chapter it was of your own book.
Unfortunately, the answer was, yeah, I wrote it. message taken.
In the end, it's sometimes a little difficult to practice what we preach because we're also human beings.
Absolutely. I spent a huge amount of time writing about all of these topics over the past 3 years, and my husband would be the first person to tell you that I wasn't always taking my own advice. But at least in the back of my mind, that's an added tool that he has to remind me. And, you know, I have the same thing I can use on him. You know, remember that chapter you read and reread and edited and then reread again?
And told me it was perfect.
Yeah.
Jessica, Estelle from Austin writes, I wonder if the financial independent operators might more often be couples who get married older than the norm and those in which one or both partners have been married before.
That's absolutely right. My research found that couples on their second marriage were quite likely to use the independent operator system. And also
because they felt that that it hadn't worked well in the first marriage?
Not necessarily. Often they had children from a first marriage, and they really wanted to protect the assets for those children. And again, yeah, they had been often burnt in the past. And then other couples who just don't believe in marriage were frequently those who kept their money separate.
My guests are Jessica Gross, an associate editor at Slate, and Paula Schumann of the Wall Street Journal, Jenny Anderson of the New York Times. We're talking about economics and related matters and the rules of such applied to marriage. We'll be back with more right after this.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, babe.
Billie Holiday, word and the wording for a prenup. My guests are Paula Schumann, The Wall Street Journal, Jenny Anderson, The New York Times, who've co-authored Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. It's from Random House. And Jessica Gross, the managing editor of Double X, an associate editor at Slate, where she recently wrote a series of articles on marital finances. And for years, it was assumed that the biggest problem in marriages was the source of most fights was sex. And it turns out it is money, isn't it?
Now, sex is a big one, too, but I think...
talk a lot about sex.
Talk a lot about sex, and married couples talk a lot about sex. Seems like they talk about it more than they actually do it, but
right.
Money is certainly a big issue that people fight about.
Let's talk a bit about sex. Were your research subjects really that frank?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised how much people will talk about their sex lives when there's a journalist in the room.
And a lot of beer and wine.
Yeah,
their friends
and, persuasive questions. And, you know, we also did this survey and asked a lot of questions about people's sex lives and, you know, why people weren't doing it. Do they wish they were doing it more? And, of course, the number one reason everybody said, most people said, yes, your sex life diminishes over time. But then a greater majority of people said it shouldn't diminish over time. So it's like, well, what's going wrong? And most people, the biggest answer why they weren't doing it more was that they were too tired, followed closely by too busy.
Mm. Too tired, meaning I don't feel like doing it right now. But we often think of sex as something that should be spontaneous. You depict a lot of couples who schedule it or make bargains as to how frequently they engage.
Yeah, we do.
Does that really work?
I think it does. I mean, I think part of the problem is we're dealing in a time period where people are dealing with jobs, kids. People are balancing a lot. And so as depressing as it may seem to have to schedule sex, if you schedule sex and have sex, that's better than not scheduling sex and not having sex. The idea being it's hard for us, and sometimes the spontaneity doesn't come. If you wait until you've put the kids to dinner, you've answered the next 17 emails, put the kids to bed, answered the 17 emails, had your dinner, get into bed. At that moment, you're really tired. I mean, people are really worn out, and they're still answering their emails, and they're still in their Blackberries. And so couples, it struck us as incredibly innovative. Some couples just said, you know, I realized that if I waited till after dinner, I was sort of catatonic. And so they would do it before dinner, and that was sort of – that helped motivate them. Or getting a babysitter for a couple hours with the sole intent of just
having sex.
And it does. I mean, of course, it takes out some of the spontaneity. But I think anyone who's been married for a while knows that, especially once kids are part of the equation, the spontaneity is a little bit ruined by them. So I think it's almost overcoming the reality that you have to get over that, and that it's still better, you know, just having the sex is good. And if it's not going to be totally crazy and spontaneous all the time.
Better to have, some sex, sort of routine sex a lot than, you know, amazing sex never, is what one guy said. But also, I mean, there was a story in the Times this week about this woman who said she was considering putting locks on the door because it was the only way she could keep her kids out from coming at the exact moment that they were trying to do it.
You dealt with only one gay couple in your book. Was that because there's a relatively small number of married gay couples, or did you just feel that they were beyond the scope of your inquiry or functioned differently as couples?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think it was just a question. I think beyond the scope of our inquiry might be a better way to put it in terms of, I mean, we would have liked to have gotten stories from all segments, but it ended up being a little bit more leaning towards heterosexual couples.
What about you, Jenny? Did gay couples also respond to your poll?
Yeah, we had a good deal of gay couples who responded, and because most of them aren't allowed to be married, they were not common potters in the same amount as straight couples. However, more of them were sometimes sharers. So they had the combination of joint and separate accounts because they had been together for a long time and wanted to sort of have some kind of legal union almost, even though they couldn't get married, which I found was sort of sweet. I had one older gay couple. They were in their late 50s, early 60s, who live in Massachusetts. And the guy I interviewed said he felt that when he and his spouse combined money, After they had been together for 5 years in their 30s, it felt almost as much of a union as when they were allowed to get officially married in 2004. So I found that was sort of profound and quite lovely.
Can we talk about some of the economics theory that that you've applied to marriage? Loss aversion, for example.
Right. So loss aversion is a concept from the field of behavioral economics that basically says that we hate to lose so much that we start acting very irrationally and counterproductively when we sense that we're losing. That's why there's pawn shops outside of casinos. They know that once people are down, they're going to bet the house. We apply that in.
But you always wind up losing more.
Well, that's
you?
The problem is so you sense you're losing and you end up losing more. And there's an interesting thing that happens, which I think a lot of couples can relate to when you're having an argument, especially if it's late at night and you're tired. You can tend to go – people tell us they go around in circles. They want to be right at all costs. When you sense that you're losing an argument, you tend to dig – some people tend to dig in their heels anymore, even more, and that's where loss aversion kicks in. And it can be really detrimental. Like 34% of the people we surveyed said they sometimes keep arguing even after they know they're wrong.
And 34% of people keep arguing after they forgot what they were originally arguing about.
Well, then it becomes your mother. And it becomes,
exactly. But that's the point. That's why you got to
You didn't bring down the garbage yesterday.
Right.
So if, everything other than what you what started the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So when the argument becomes more about winning than about resolving conflict, then we suggest like your loss aversion is taking over and maybe it's time to take a time out.
You have a chapter on trade-offs and opportunity costs. What are examples of opportunity costs?
Well, opportunity cost is what you give up to get something that you want. And so sometimes we don't consider everything that goes into giving something up. So if you're going to buy a house in the suburbs, you're not just giving up the life in the city, you're giving up time with your children because you're going to have to compete a lot more. So I think what we look at in the chapter on trade-offs are some of the sort of decision-making biases we apply when making trade-offs. So some of the mistakes almost we make when trying to weigh trade-offs. And, for example, a huge one is sort of always thinking of big solutions. I know, for example, I'll give you an example from my personal life. I had 2 sick kids for the entire month of December, and I honestly must have made 15 pronouncements about we were leaving the city, we were leaving Manhattan, we were never going to let our kids play with other kids. It just everything felt so huge. And economists would say, think at the margin, think of incremental change, weigh the costs and benefits of incremental change, and actually those have a much bigger impact. My husband suggested, well, why don't we just find a childcare provider who's good with very, very sick infants and they can, and leave the house for a couple hours and we'll probably feel a little bit better. And alas, we came back and I didn't feel the need to flee Manhattan.
But, you also talk about ultimatums, and it's often what happens is we find ourselves at a point where we're saying, well, this is it. This is the end, whether it's leaving town or if you don't do this, the marriage is over. How do we get pushed to that point? And how does – is this really something that Adam Smith would have thought about?
if you don't do this, I'm going to leave you. Well, Adam Smith was a lifelong bachelor, so he probably – he lived with his mother. So I think he got all of his laundry taken care of for him.
But there's you talk about the ultimatum game.
Well, the ultimatum game is actually an example of how trust is an incredible incentive. Oh, am I getting this wrong? Jenny's making a face at me.
Well, the ultimatum game is a great example of how much we care about fairness.
Right.
Because the ultimatum game is basically, all right, I'm going to give you $100 and you have to decide. And you can give any portion of that $100 to a complete stranger. You can give nothing. You can give $99. You can give all of it. And the question is, what will people do? Are they truly the self-interested, profit-maximizing creatures that classical economists thought us to be? If so, you would keep it all. You're never going to see this person again. Who cares? You don't get a dime. And it turns out that we care about fairness a lot. I mean, behavioral economists love this study because it shows that, again, when sort of we're not just out for ourselves, we care a lot about fairness. It turns out that the majority of people end up giving $40 or $50 away in this game. Sorry, I left out a critical piece of this game. The other person, if they feel like the offer is unfair, can reject it. So if you give a dollar and the person rejects it, neither one of you gets anything. So the question is, how much do you have to – what's the most you have to give away of your $100 so that the other person doesn't reject it? And the majority of people give $40 to $50. And it's a sense of how much we care about fairness. In economics, they call it inequity aversion. We don't like getting, the short end of the stick, basically.
My guests are Jenny Anderson and Paula Schumann, Their book, Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. It's published by Random House. And also Jessica Gross of Slate and Double X Magazines. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. A listener from Los Angeles, Francisco, writes, at what point do you become too absorbed by the rules? Does marriage for certain personality types ultimately mean constantly clarifying the precepts in order to feel loved? Can this become more of a task than a marriage?
Well, I think, when it starts becoming more work than fun, we get married these days because we enjoy each other's company. You know, the irony is there's no economic necessity anymore like there used to be. So if it is more work than fun, I think you probably want to ask yourself what's going on. And we're basically saying in the book that try and get in and out of these problems as quickly as possible so that you can get back to the fun part.
We were talking earlier about pooling resources. What about pooling information? I mean, how open do people feel that they have to be with each other?
A lot of people we interviewed said that they actually regretted being too honest with their spouses more often than they regretted being dishonest. But it's actually a fine line because you want to be transparent and you want to be open, but you also don't want to overload your spouse, which is something we call, you don't want to impose high information processing costs. And there's this, stereotype of, or a lot of people actually, without even stereotype, people told us they just get, one little argument about one specific thing gets turned into this global showdown of everything that the other person did wrong. And that's definitely information overload.
And I had a question in my survey about financial infidelity, sort of, do you have a secret bank account? How honest with your partner are you about your finances? And I feel like there is a point where you can be too honest about the money that you're spending. I mean, I don't think that partners need to know every last cent of every purchase. They don't need to know that you bought a Diet Coke with lunch today. And I think there are some hardliners who say your partner should know everything. How can you buy a shirt and not tell the person what it costs?
No,
but I think that that's ridiculous. I think you can go way too far with full disclosure.
I remember telling my mom, I was discussing with my mother some of the data from this survey, and I said, it's amazing. More people regretted sharing too much. My mom said, there's nothing amazing about that. Being married requires some amount of self-editing and some amount of self-censorship because it's consideration. It's care. You don't want to say everything that's on your mind in the moment that it comes to you, or you might say some very regrettable things.
Right.
I think this is something that comes with maturity and experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You do say a lot of those things. I used to date a woman who blah, blah, blah. And then you discover that's not a good
thing. And then you look across the table.
Not good to talk about those things. You've developed a couple's confidence index. What's that?
Well, one of the things we talk about in the book is overconfidence and this idea that sort of contributes to economic booms and busts.
You even talk about bubbles.
Bubbles, yeah. The bubbles.
You know about housing bubbles and dot-com bubbles.
Yeah, exactly.
How does that apply to
the marriage bubble? It's interesting to think about, right? Half of all marriages still end in divorce, and yet people will spend tens of thousands of dollars on their marriages completely 100% confident that that they won't be that statistic.
There's this great survey in West Virginia where I think it was 137 couples who had recently married were asked two questions. One is, what is the national rate of divorce, and they all accurately predicted about 50%. And then they were asked, what is the chance that you will get divorced? And the answer was 0%. Mm-hmm. So I think if you're looking for evidence that we're very overconfident about marriage.
And we're not saying not to be optimistic, but we do have this idea in the book, like take this couple's confidence index, which is related to the consumer confidence index, to gauge where you are in your marriage right now. Do you assume that you'll never split up? Do you assume you'll be together forever? Just keep tabs on what's going on.
Don't people pool their resources because that's all part of this confidence?
They do. I mean,
the sense of confidence.
I think often people who are common potters may be the most confident. But the thing is, unless you have a prenup, and Americans are still really averse to prenups. I think it's something like 2-3% of Americans. So no matter if you are legally married, no matter which of these systems you choose, if you're in most states have either equitable or equal distribution of assets. If you get divorced, your money is going to be, you're going to have to give some money to your spouse. So in some ways, these systems are sort of just psychological, thinking that you have some money for yourself. Because if it ends, you're going to have to give it up anyway.
Yeah, I mean, when my husband and I pooled all our resources, there was, you know, and opened that joint checking account. It was this great feeling of, okay, well, we're not married yet, but we're sharing our money. And that's an amazing commitment.
You also talk about game theory as applied to marriage. You're not talking about all those people say, online dating, no game players.
Right. No, we're saying do play games. No, well, game theory is the
strategic polarization.
Right. It's looking at, you know, behavior in strategic situations and with two or more players, as they say in game theory. And, you know, people, when you have two people in a marriage, you know, you're both trying to get what you want in certain situations, but also trying to help the other person get what they want. And it's a constant negotiation and a balancing act. And there's some interesting lessons from game theory. This, you point out, strategic polarization, where two people start out sort of an agreement, and for some reason at the end of the day they completely disagree. And we have a couple who agreed that they wanted to live in the same kind of a place in Brooklyn while they were looking to rent a new apartment, and by the end of the day they were completely polarized. They didn't see any value in each other's opinion. You know, he wanted to move I can't remember, Crown Heights or something, and she wanted to move to Park Slope, and they actually shared very similar values, but they had been polarized and sort of had lost perspective in the ability to compromise.
Been polarized by the real world, looking at places in the different neighborhoods.
Yeah, and also feeling like the other person is insisting that it be their way, which can be alienating.
Well, this does the prisoner's dilemma problem apply to marriage?
Good question. Well, the prisoner's dilemma is where the classic example is where two prisoners are in separate rooms and they're being interrogated and accused of a crime, and they are told if one rats the other out and the other person, if I rat you out and you don't rat me out, then, you know, I get to go free. So the whole basic premise is how is the other person going to act in your interest or against your interest? And how do you act in your own best interest, not knowing what the other person is going to do? Well, in a marriage, you can know what the other person is going to do because it's what we call a repeated game. You can learn from your previous mistakes or successes. So the idea is that you can actually collude and compromise rather than just assume that the other person is going to have your worst interests at heart.
Game theory is really just the art of it's strategic thinking. I remember someone said to me, that's so unromantic and it's so sort of crass and mathematical. How could you do that? And I said, you know, at the end of the day, if my husband is really trying to anticipate how I feel about something and then gauge his actions based on that reaction, I think that's actually quite sweet.
Thank you all so much for being with us. We've been talking with Paula Schumann and Jenny Anderson, co-authors of Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. It's published by Random House. Jessica Gross, associate editor at Slate and managing editor of Double X. And she wrote a series of articles on marital finances recently for Slate. Also co-author of the book Love, Mom, Poignant, Goofy, Brilliant Messages from Home.
Indeed. Have me back for Mother's Day. I can talk all about it.
Well, maybe we will. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.